Hello, this is Chris Yerkes reading to you from the April 12th edition of the Journal. We'll start with the front page story. Tuscola reviews budget for upcoming fiscal year by Dominic Stallings. The Tuscola City Council reviewed the budget draft for the upcoming fiscal year 2024. The city has several capital projects proposed in the draft edition of the budget, all of which add up to $6 million. City Treasurer Alta Long said the city is technically running a deficit budget for this year. However, all of the projects are budgeted with city savings, which are not included in revenue for the city. Long said the city's cash fund balance and reserve accounts will still be in good shape. City Administrator Drew Hole said that the city has accomplished a budget for all of the projects with cash on hand without relying on borrowing money. Most of the projects are carried out from the fiscal year 2023, such as the proposed street shed and fire department. The city previously increased its levy by 25% due to an expired tax increment funding, TIF, district. Mayor Dan Kleiss said many of the building projects are tremendous for the community for the next 20 to 25 years. Long also noted that state tax revenue has increased by 70% from the fiscal year 2019 through 2023. Interest rates have also risen significantly from under $7,000 to over $112,000. Long noted that the increase came from the federal government increasing interest rate due to high inflation rates in the last 2 years. Inflation has been between 6 and 8% for the last 2 years, said Long. In other news, Tuscola City Council approved an ordinance amending Section 52.29 of the City of Tuscola Code or Ordinances to increase the reimbursement amount for sidewalk repair or replacement from $7 to $15 per linear foot. The reimbursement goes up to half of the project cost. The ordinance change would be effective starting in the new fiscal year. Hole said the city also budgeted around $100,000 for an annual project to build out repairs and replacement of sidewalks. The council also approved the $30,000 contract with American Patriot Pyro Inc. The company conducted the fireworks display last year for the city. The council approved the purchase of Auger Monster repair parts for $222,000 from JWC Environmental. According to City Administrator Drew Hold, the Auger Monster is a grinder and screen device that removes debris from the wastewater stream before it enters the wastewater treatment plant. The current Auger Monster is original to the plant when it was constructed in the early 2000s. It requires a new gearbox, motor, and screen. The council approved the purchase of a butterfly valve that would act as a backstop for the existing control valve at the master meter station adjacent to the Route 45 overpass. The valve cost $13,800 from Engineered Solutions Midwest and $6,500 from Donahue Associates for reprogramming the SCADA controls of the master meter station. According to Hole, the existing control valve is not operating perfectly and leads to occasional overflow at the Tuscola Water Tower, which adds costs to water operations. The valve tends to fail when the upstream pressure is not high enough. This seems to happen when high demand downstream to Cabot and Arcola or West Prairie lowers the pressure. The Illinois EPA approved the project plan for the master meter station replacement and Meadowview water main replacement. It is likely the project will at least receive loan funding. The application is entering a scoring process to determine the interest rate and principal forgiveness, which is a portion of the loan that will be forgiven upon completion. The council approved the purchase of a replacement lawnmower that was ordered in the summer of 2021. The cost of the mower is $22,000, which has been budgeted for. The cost does not include a trade-in. Hole explains that the city would keep the old one to use in Wimple Park as a spare. The city has not heard anything new on a second new mower, which is included. The city is still awaiting a revised site plan from Elk Development Limited, a division of Pivot Energy Incorporated, to propose solar project, which will be located south of the Southland Acres subdivision along the Egyptian Trail. Once the city receives it, a special use permit application will be presented to the council. During the demolition of the Castle Mall, a time capsule was found within the cornerstone. Hole is working with the Douglas County Museum on details, but it is planned to be opened on May 8th, City Council meeting, the same date as the 165th anniversary of the Tuscola Presbyterian Church founding. The City Council gave a moment of silence for Marta Slaughter, who died suddenly on Sunday. Marta was the wife of Alderman David Slaughter. The other first page story, Villa Grove's Gina Black Reaches Coaching Milestone by Tony Hooker. The plan for Gina Black wasn't to be a coach. Her goal when she went to the UIUC was to work in genetic counseling, a program the university dropped soon after her admission. After 100-plus wins as head coach at Villa Grove, it's a pretty safe bet to say that the fate had the correct career in mind for her. She and I recently sat down to discuss how it came to be her softball program and what the future might hold. Did you always know you were going to be a coach? Absolutely not. My plan was to do genetic counseling, and they dropped that program during my sophomore year. I kept taking courses aligned with the pre-med track, planning on eventually transferring, but I always loved sports, so all my electives were whatever sport I could get into. After 5 years, my dad said, "I'm done paying. What are we doing here?" And I found that I could be a PE teacher. I didn't know that I had the confidence to be a coach, and Rick Green talked me into coaching rec ball. I was a nervous wreck at first, but then I fell in love with it. There's been a lot of talent in the Villa Grove softball program over the years, but what do you think your strength in maximizing that strength has been? I've been able to surround myself with good people, coaching with Carrie Cheeley, Heather Van Lanken, Amber Schweikart, and Floyd Fisher, all who had such good knowledge, and I've been able to put all that together. I'm smart enough to know when I'm not good enough to do it on my own, so I've surrounded myself with good people. You're at 100 wins now. How many more do you think you have left in you? 100? 150? Maybe. I enjoy it. I've also been fortunate enough to be part of a program where the parents and the kids buy in. They're playing 100 games during the summer, so they're learning a lot outside of our program. The kids come in and trust what we ask of them, so if they can continue to do that and be successful, I might have another 100. You and I have talked about this year's team, and you know the potential is there. You've run into some early season roadblocks. Do you think it'll be helpful in the long term building off of those? We sent them a message yesterday saying how adversity only makes you stronger. We came up against a strong Charleston team. I know they'd be tough and we folded. We have to learn to fight a little harder. Casey was by far the best game we've played. They're a good team, currently ranked number one in 2A, even though they're a 1A this year, and that game could have gone either way. I left there happier than I was after we beat Urbana by 19 runs because we looked like the team I've been expecting to have. Last night we went extra innings against Windsor. When you have 8 games scheduled in a week, it's a good time to have 2 extra inning games in a row. Unity was a good game, but the weather conditions were horrible. But Unity had to play in the same conditions as we did, so we just had to overcome things like that. Last year we started out hitting the ball so well, but we peaked a little too early. This year I feel like being knocked down a few times might allow us to peak a little bit later. I tell them all the time that what matters is how we're playing in May. I don't sleep too well at night after we don't play well now, but I think that's in the long run it'll help us. You don't shy away from playing top competition either. Is that intentional? It's very intentional. We start out our season that way. Then when we get into the conference play and play against some of those 1A teams that we're going to see in the postseason, and them games seem a little easier. Usually by now we've gone to Tennessee and played a lot of big-time schools down there. We switched it up a bit this year. We're going to go to Kentucky in May. It's by design that we play tough teams early and figure out our weaknesses, so we have a better team in May. You have some youngsters who are in that lineup. I saw that Izzy hit her first homer the other day. She's hit 2 of them for us now. Piper Kaiser's playing middle field for us. She has a great bat. It's a big jump from junior high to high school. In practice, she hits it as hard as anyone, but she's struggling a bit in games. It can be a little bit overwhelming. She's pitching for us, and she's done well in the circle. Hayden Thomas is another freshman contributor. She's super fast and can track down anything in the outfield, but she struggled a bit at the plate. The last couple of games, she's been starting to figure some things out. It just seems like it's a program now. You don't have a good team every couple of years and then fall off the map and have to fight your way back up. Is that a good assessment? That's a very good assessment. Every couple of years, you get 3 or 4, and with a 1A school, if you're 5 or 6 good players, you can usually compete. When and where are you going to Kentucky? We'll be going to Owensboro, Kentucky on May 5th and 6th. We've always went to Tennessee, but during COVID we couldn't go, but the kids still wanted to have a trip and we found this one. They have great facilities and competition, but it's a little bit closer. Last year we went to Tennessee and this year we're going to Owensboro. I think that we'll alternate between the two moving forward. You're playing schools with 2,000 or 3,000 kids in them at these tournaments, right? I just got our schedule and we're playing Owensboro Catholic, Breckenridge, Colorado, which I believe is a 4A school in Illinois. I'm not sure who our final game will be against, but I'm sure they're bigger than a school of 200. It's got to be a real confidence booster for your ladies to be able to compete against and beat schools like that, right? It is. We always play better against teams we know nothing about. We get hung up on, oh, we're playing Unity, we're playing St. Joe, we're playing Tuscola. They get in our heads that they're bigger and better than they are. I think that sometimes they make them out to be better than they actually are. They don't know anything about Casey. They don't know until after the game that they were ranked number one in the state in 2A until after the game when we told them, and they played far better than when we played Unity. I think it benefits us not to know anything about them, and then we play them and we can explain that they have 2,000 kids in their school, and that's a big confidence builder. Are you still as confident in their potential as you were before the season began? I still feel good about that. We've exposed our weaknesses and we know what we have to work on. I keep telling them that we have all the pieces, we just need to figure out how to put them together. We've messed with our lineups. I don't think we've had the exact same lineup for any two games this season. We're still figuring out who best fits where and what's the best combination we can put out. I've thrown four different pitchers and we're still figuring it out, and they've got a ton of potential. Logan Lillard seems to be pitching a lot of bad luck, right? Bad luck. She recently changed her motion, which down the road is going to help her a lot, but we're still working out a lot of kinks on that. Good luck for the rest of your season. Thank you. Now we'll move to the obituaries. Lester Thompson, 91, of Ames, Iowa, formerly of Arcola, died on March 14, 2023. Graveside services will be held at 1:30 p.m. on Saturday, April 15, 2023, at the Arcola Cemetery with Pastor Brent Budd officiating. Schrader Funeral Home Arcola is assisting the family with arrangements. Online condolences to the family may be shared at www.hillgossingrathfh.com. Joseph Alvin Jacobs, 89, of Charleston, passed away at 7:50 p.m. on Monday, April 3, 2023, surrounded by his wife and loved ones at his daughter's residence in Lawrenceville. Visitation was held Friday, April 7th at the Edwards Funeral Home, Arcola. Funeral services were held Saturday, April 8th at the Edwards Funeral Home. Burial was in the Cartwright Cemetery in rural Tuscola. Tim Edwards, Jordan Phillip, Jonathan Jacobs, Sierra Philpott, Jenna Jacobs, and Carden Doherty served as pallbearers, with Jeffrey Fitzgerald and Evan Doherty serving as honorary pallbearers. Christina L. Heasley, 84, of Camargo, finished her journey on Earth and returned to her heavenly home on March 22, 2023, after an almost four-year battle with Alzheimer's. There will be a celebration of the life later in the year with details to be announced. In lieu of flowers, the family requests donations be made to the Alzheimer's Association. Lester Thompson, 91, of Ames, Iowa, formerly of Arcola, died on March 14, 2023. Graveside services will be held at 1:30 p.m. on Saturday, April 15th at the Arcola Cemetery with Pastor Brent Budd assisting. Schrader Funeral Home Arcola is assisting the family with arrangements. There will be a celebration of life gathering for Steve Sanderson at the Moose Lodge, 807 East South Line Road, Tuscola, on April 29th from 1 to 5 p.m. The full obituary was in the January 4th edition. The gathering will be informal for those who knew Steve and will understand what he would want. In lieu of flowers, memorials may be made to Tuscola's Moose Lodge or the donor's choice. Ryan Rutledge Miller, 29, of Kansas City, Missouri, formerly of Arthur, passed away at 6:31 p.m. on Wednesday, April 15, 2023, in a motor vehicle accident in Emporia, Kansas. Visitation will be held from 2 to 4 p.m. and 6 to 8 p.m. on Tuesday, April 11th at the Arthur Mennonite Church, 710 East Park Street, Arthur. Funeral services will be held at 10 a.m. on Wednesday, April 12th at the church. Pastor Glenn Rhodes will officiate. Burial will be in the Arthur Cemetery. The Edwards Funeral Home is assisting with arrangements. Please share Ryan's love of the animals or elephants at the Kansas City Zoo and make a donation in his honor at www.kansascityzoo.org. Dorothy Marie Otto, 77, of Arthur, passed away at 5:55 p.m. on Wednesday, April 5th, 2023, at Sarah Bush Lincoln Health Center, surrounded by her family. Visitation was held Friday, April 7th, and Saturday, April 8th, at the Sunnyside Mennonite Church, rural Arcola. Funeral services were held Monday, April 10th, at the church. Pastor Luke Goss and Pastor Larry Rock officiated. Burial was at the Sunnyside Mennonite Church Cemetery. The Edwards Funeral Home assisted with arrangements. John D. Nelson of Villa Grove was born on October 30, 1944, at Burnham City Hospital in Champaign to Hans H. Nelson and Madonna Barnum. He passed away March 24, 2023, in Jacksonville, Florida. His family will be hosting an open house to celebrate his life on May 13th from 2 to 5 p.m. at the Lake House at Crystal Park in Urbana. In lieu of flowers, the family would appreciate donations to the Champaign Park Foundation, made in John's name, to be placed on a memorial bench. Jerry Hudson, 78, of Camargo, passed away Wednesday, March 29, 2023, at Carl Foundation Hospital in Urbana, surrounded by his family. Visitation services were held April 6th at Joins Funeral Home Villa Grove, with Pastor Dwayne Piercy officiating a prayer. In lieu of flowers, memorials may be made to the Douglas County Humane Society, Victory Church of Camargo, or Towers of Tunnels. Joan Joy Kingery, 89, of Arthur, died at 9:48 p.m. Monday, April 3, 2023, at Sarah Bush Lincoln Health Center, Mattoon. Funeral services were held Monday, April 10th, at the Schrader Funeral Home, Arthur, with Pastor John Sylvanek officiating. Burial followed at the Cartwright Cemetery, rural Tuscola. Visitation was held prior to the service at the funeral home. Memorials are suggested to the Arthur Library, Arthur EMT Association, or Arthur Fire Department. Now we have My Personal Side by Craig Hastings. As expected, President Donald Trump was indicted by Manhattan DA Alvin Bragg. Bragg charged Trump with 34 felony charges built from one simple misdemeanor charge of allegedly paying hush money to porn star Stormy Daniels. Her real name is Stephanie Gregory Clifford, if it matters. Clifford alleges that she met Trump in 2006 at a golf tournament in Lake Tahoe. One comment led to another, and she claims she and Trump later had they even engaged in sexual encounter. Trump denies the allegation, which means we will never know for sure what happened. In the big scheme of things, who cares? I certainly don't need the details of someone's sexual history, especially one 16 years ago. Furthermore, what the man does in his personal life is of no concern to me as an American citizen, who is more concerned about voting someone into office that can not only make the majority of Americans' lives better, but also my family's lives. Was there a time in my life when a presidential candidate's morality was a concern to me as a voter? It most certainly was. Times have changed. The world has changed. The world is at war again. America's economic fate is in jeopardy. China and Russia have recently teamed up and pledged to replace the American dollar as the world standard with China's own yuan. Russia has already stepped up and is recognizing the yuan as the most traded currency in their country. North Korea, Iran, Saudi Arabia, and India may soon follow suit. Where is the Biden administration, and what plan might they have to deter such a move? To date, I haven't heard or read of another single country pledging to back the United States dollar as their choice in the global standard of currency. Maybe they believe that such a bold move by the Chinese isn't even possible. I'm afraid, as with so many other blunders by the Biden administration, there isn't a plan to stop or deter China from moving forward with their plan to become the world's most powerful economic force. Only when it's too late will Biden's circus monkeys gather together in some dark corner in the White House and discuss what to do. The first thing they will do is come up with some fairy tale placing the blame on the Trump administration, i.e. China's spy balloons, our crashing economy, Afghanistan evacuation debacle, gas prices, Iran's nuclear weapon advancement, etc. Back in the Trump indictments, D.A. Bragg, according to some of the greatest constitutional minds in the country, has taken a misdemeanor event that occurred long ago and expired under the statute of limitations and Frankensteined it into one event into 32 separate felony charges. So why would Bragg do such a thing? He's a New York native who has aspirations to be governor one day. Charging Donald Trump as promised in his campaign to win the district attorney's election last year in Manhattan District is his best way to rally the Democrats in New York. Win or lose the Trump case, New York Democrats won't care. As long as Bragg causes Trump grief is all they care about. These charges give them a glimpse of hope that one day Donald Trump will be cuffed and taken to jail. They hate they have the Trump and how Trump had completely set Washington, D.C. on its head in 2016 is the only thing important to them now. You see, unlike me, you and me, these people have no financial worries now and never will. They have no fear of ever becoming arrested for anything that they do. Sure, Trump managed to call many of these people out, and some of them were caught red-handed wrongdoing, but even so, none of them have spent a day in jail. Oh no, only Republicans have been charged and spent any time in jail. Most were released after the evidence later to prove their innocence, but not before 3 o'clock a.m. FBI raids on their home. So why Trump and why now? Please don't assume it's because the Democrats in D.C. want to keep him out of the 2024 presidential race. No, I think there'd be another angle to this. I think the Democrats want Trump to be the candidate that runs against Joe Biden in 2024. They figure if Biden did it once, he can beat Trump again. Of course, old Joe won't even know what he's running for anymore, but for the next ice cream cone. Who Democrats fear most is Ron DeSantis. They know, as I do, there isn't a Democrat today that could beat DeSantis if the election was next week. The Republican nominee will be Trump or DeSantis. Democrats have decided Trump is their best bet to beat in 2024. The plan is to rally the Republicans' base around Trump in the primary and then knock him off of many races with as many criminal indictments as they can after the primary. If I was in their camp, I'd be planning to do the same. We're a year and a half out right now, so there are many news cycles between now and then, so anything could happen. The left-wing press will continue to beat up on Trump for now. If it wasn't for Trump news, they wouldn't have any news at all. All their ratings continue to plummet into the toilet without Trump news. There are two things America needs desperately from our next president. One, we need a president that has a proven good business sense to turn the economic state of America back on its head. And two, we need a president that wants to keep us out of wars around the world, and at the same time, build our military back to be one that the world fears. Sure, America is suffering in so many other areas right now, but how can the lesser problems ever be fixed if we don't stabilize the biggest problems? Pay attention, Americans. China is preparing the big move in the world stage, and America needs to be getting ready to counter that big move. Unfortunately, with a president that's more concerned about ice cream cone flavors, successfully climbing the stairs on Air Force One, and shaking hands with invisible people on stage, I fear for us all, especially our children. In other news, Illinois Supreme Court to appoint a new judge for Douglas County by Dominic Stallings. The Illinois Supreme Court will appoint a new circuit judge for Douglas County since Circuit Judge Richard Broach retired at the end of March. An appointed judge will serve the county until then, November 24th. Afterward, an election will determine who would serve the six-year period. Currently, Douglas County only has one judge. Associate Judge Gary Weber works in Douglas, Piatt, DeWitt, and Moultrie counties. Illinois Supreme Court Justice David K. Overstreet put together a screening committee that will interview candidates and inform him who is qualified for the appointed position. So far, two candidates have applied, attorney Andrew Baquet and state's attorney Kate Watson. They will have interviews on April 13th. Both candidates have a long history of working in Douglas County. Baquet has been working as an attorney for 20 years and spent 16 years of those in Tuscola. He currently works at the law office of Tumbleson, Bryan, and Knox in Urbana. He previously worked at Beckett Law Office PC, which closed on January 1st. Baquet still sees clients at the Tuscola office on an appointment basis. "I've had the privilege to serve every municipality in Douglas County except for Villa Grove," said Baquet. Kate Watson has worked in Douglas County for 27 years. She started working as an assistant state's attorney in 1996. She was first elected Douglas County state's attorney in 2016 and has been elected twice. "I think I've been a fair prosecutor who has worked for justice in the community," said Watson. Baquet has applied to be judge several times. "I think it would be an incredible privilege and honor," said Baquet. He and his broad background in law would be his biggest qualifier for the position. He has experience in criminal, family, and election law, and more. Baquet has also done appellate law, which is the process of appealing verdicts up the chain of courts for review. Watson said she is the lead law enforcement officer in Douglas County. As a state's attorney, she has responsibility of prosecuting felony, misdemeanor, and traffic charges committed in Douglas County. She also represents Douglas County in any civil matters that may come up. Watson previously represented the county regarding some legal issues regarding wind farms. She also sued the state, along with Sheriff Nathan Chapman, over the Safety Act. She also serves as a chief legal advisor to the county board, county officials, and department heads. Both Baquet and Watson plan to run in the election following the judge's appointment. Baquet said he would start his election campaign if he were appointed judge. Watson said the chairman of the Republican Party would recommend a replacement for the state's attorney position if she were appointed as judge. The Douglas County judge appointment is expected to be announced later in April. There's an article, How to Prepare Landscapes for New Plantings This Spring. New plants can add much to a landscape, whether replacing plants that are no longer thriving or being added to supplement the existing landscape. New plants are an affordable way to give a home's exterior a whole new look. Much consideration is given to which plants to add to a landscape. That's understandable, as homeowners want to choose plants that will thrive and won't compromise the health of surrounding plants and trees. Before planting or even choosing plants, it's important to plan for new additions to a landscape. Preparing the landscape can inform homeowners about which plants to purchase and can ensure that they thrive after planting. Document sunlight exposure. Plants have different needs, and one of the biggest differences between species is the amount of sunlight they need to thrive. According to Penn State Extension, plants characterized as full sun require 6 or more hours of sunlight per day, while those considered partial sun need between 4 and 6 hours of sunlight per day. Plants designated as partial shade need between 2 to 4 hours of sun per day, while shade plants need less than 2 hours of sunlight a day. Documenting sunlight exposure in advance gives homeowners an idea of which plants should be planted and where they should be planted. Jot down these observations in a journal over several weeks, and then choose plants that will thrive in each area. 2. Test the soil. A soil pH test is a simple and quick way to determine the acidity of the soil. Soil pH levels will indicate how likely a plant is to thrive in a given spot. High levels won't necessarily mean an area should be avoided, as some plants thrive in acidic soils. Additional soil tests can determine other characteristics, such as nutrient level of soil and the amount of organic matter it contains. Each of these variables can help homeowners make the right choices as they introduce new plants to their properties. 3. Consider local wildlife. If local wildlife makes its presence known on a property, homeowners may want to take proactive steps prior to planting anything new. A new fence might prevent animals like deer from getting in, but that look likely won't do much to repel smaller animals like squirrels, rabbits, or foxes. If wildlife is a concern, homeowners can seek advice at their local garden center about which plants certain animals are likely to ignore. Homeowners who want to attract wildlife can do the same in reverse, choosing plants wildlife will be drawn to. Homeowners who want to deter wildlife should erect fencing or other barriers prior to planting. 4. Clear space if necessary. Plants grow up and out, and cramped quarters can make it hard for new plants to thrive. Some may thrive, but only at the expense of other plants. If necessary, clear space prior to planting to ensure plants have ample space to grow. And now we can turn to some of the columns. Genealogy turns up a sister I didn't know I had. Memories and Musing by Sherry Sims. Just when you think you have life figured out and everything is back on an even keel, something monumental happens and your whole perspective changes. I will tell you that ending first. I have a biological half-sister. Yep, after being an only child for 75 years, I suddenly have a sibling, a baby sister. She's 5 years younger. I had wished for a sister or brother all my life, but never happened until last week. A couple of weeks ago, I wrote about researching my family tree for health reasons, but I certainly never expected to be given such a gift and will still not know about this event if a secretary at a cemetery had not taken an interest in my inquiry and decided to use her recently acquired genealogy talents to help me. We have the same father. His name is listed on both of our birth certificates, and her name was listed on his obituary in 2001, but mine was not listed. The secretary thought that was odd, and that I was inquiring about the grave, and I was not listed in the obituary, so she began to research the listed daughter and found her name and address and phone and gave that information to me. She was concerned because I did not have this information, was laboring under the false information, as I had told her that I was an only biological child. Since I leave no stone unturned, I immediately placed a call to the woman, and lo and behold, she knew about me but did not know my name or any other information and has never had any interest in genealogy, nor did she believe it was true. We talked for over 2 hours. We have that in common. And she said she had not met her biological father until he was 70 years old, but then they became friends and for the last 7 years of his life. The first few years of our respective lives were similar. Our parents were together for about 5 years. We were planned, but not for long after we arrived, our father left and never returned. Both our mothers moved in with our grandparents and life continued. I ended up meeting our biological father when I was 13 and spent 2 summers with him and a later vacation when my son was born, but then we lost contact again. Over the 3 weeks I have been doing research, I have met via telephone another first cousin, and she and I have compared information and have been able to formulate a timeline for our family. The cousin actually had a scrap of paper with my sister's name on it, but no one in her family was able to uncover further facts. She too is as surprised as I am and never expected to find another family member. Suffice it to say that we all three have lots of questions and will most likely be burning up the phone lines and texting frequently. I'm in hopes of meeting both these ladies as they both sound nice on the phone and we seem to have a lot in common. Aside from my new family drama, I've been enjoying reading all the stories about the upcoming coronation of King Charles. I've always had an interest in Great Britain's royal family after writing about them my sophomore year in high school. I spent hours at the library researching Queen Elizabeth and Queen Victoria, and I never lost interest like I did with most of my other writing assignments. I guess I can blame my English teacher. She had lived in England for a couple of years and had first-hand knowledge about the country and its customs. One of this teacher's novel ideas was to have us study English foods and read cookbooks from the Victorian age. I was so entranced during the 6-week period of English class that I actually made an A in my writing course. I have discovered a most intriguing English heritage website, Victorian Way, a cooking site with videos, podcasts, and recipes from the Victorian era. Miss Hipperston looks just like my English teacher when I've been enthralled watching the videos. Reading about the royal family and watching these video reenactments is much better than watching a daytime soap. And that is all we have time for this week. This is Chris Yerke saying, see you next week.